Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Our first case for this morning is case number 10-2212, Bruce Barton v. Zimmer, Incorporated. Ms. Rockwell.
Good morning. I'm Cynthia Rockwell, and I represent the appellant, Bruce Barton. May it please the court, we are here on appeal of the trial court's grant of summary judgment in Zimmer's favor on Mr. Barton's ADEA discrimination and retaliation claims and his FMLA interference claim. The retaliation claim in this case is a classic textbook retaliation case where the events are basically undisputed. Mr. Barton held the only position at Zimmer that was responsible for teaching Zimmer's sales force in the area of consultative selling skills and for management and leadership training. He was not a manager of sales training. Those individuals were responsible for training Zimmer's sales force in the complexities of Zimmer's knees, hips, trauma, and extremities products. Starting in May of 2004, when Richardson became Barton's new boss, and continuing until May of 2005, when Richardson told Barton he needed to look for another job, Mr. Richardson took away all of Barton's selling skills job duties and all of Barton's management leadership training duties. He gave the selling skills duties to two substantially younger individuals, and he gave Barton meaningless busy work, all for the stated purpose of getting rid of Barton, because Richardson had an agenda to rid the department of all the old guys, starting with Barton. In May of 2005, when Richardson told Barton he needed to look for another job, Barton had enough and filed a written complaint and accused Richardson of age discrimination. Richardson became enraged, immediately took that complaint to Zimmer's HR director, Abel, and demanded that Zimmer remove Barton from his position. Richardson went back to the department and announced to Barton's coworkers that Barton was done, finished, fired because he dared to complain and accuse Richardson of age discrimination, and that Zimmer's HR was on board with that action. And in fact, Zimmer's HR was on board with that action. Mr. Abel proceeded to remove Barton from his unique selling skills position and go further than that and assign Barton to a sales training position, a position that Zimmer knew required months and months of on-the-job and in-the-field training that Barton did not have and that Zimmer did not intend to provide him. We know all of this happened because of the evidence in the record. We know it from Abel's June 14, 2005 memo to Richardson and Zimmer's outside legal counsel that said they were going to proceed to remove Barton from his position. In that memo, Abel said, the likely outcome will be Barton's termination. But instead of terminating Barton, Zimmer changed direction after removing Barton from the special position and decided to put him in the selling skills position that required all the training that Barton didn't have. And we know that's true from the evidence in the record at sealed volume 7 and 8, specifically pages 239, 360, and 443, and volume 4, page 480, which are Zimmer's own admissions in their answers to interrogatories, affidavits, deposition excerpts, and an email that Richardson sent on September 9th of 2005, before Richardson was terminated, telling Zimmer's personnel file that Barton was no longer the manager of performance improvement and development, but was now just a sales training manager. This is where the court got it wrong. The trial court ignored all that evidence and instead just said simply because Zimmer terminated Richardson and not Barton, that there was no adverse action. But this case isn't about the adverse action of termination. It's about the adverse action of removing Barton from a position in which he had skill and expertise and assigning him to a position that required months and months of on-the-job training, which Barton did not have and which Zimmer did not provide him.
What possible remedy would be available for that, if that's the discrete act of retaliation that's alive in this case, because he didn't suffer any loss of benefits, any loss of pay, any loss of job title? The duties were simply changed, and there's an argument about whether that was a materially adverse job action against him, employment action against him, but let's assume that it was. What remedy is there for that? Because he didn't suffer any tangible loss in terms of pay or benefits or title.
But when
he came back from a lengthy medical leave, Richardson was shortly thereafter gone on his complaints, apparently, your client's complaints about his performance, among others, and an investigation that he wasn't a good manager, and the remaining treatment by the HR director and Richardson's replacement was not materially adverse to your client.
But it was, Your Honor. It absolutely was materially adverse to my client. And the standard for retaliation set by the Supreme Court is not necessarily looking at the prior definitions of materially adverse. It is now whether the actions they took against Barton would dissuade a reasonable worker from filing a complaint.
That's correct. But under the ADEA, don't you still have to show loss of wages or benefits?
No, you don't have to show losses of wages or benefit. The case law is full of descriptions of adverse action that don't involve a loss of wage and benefits. They involve, at the time of the adverse action,
Under Title VII or other statutes, that's clearly correct. And there would be all kinds of remedies available. But given that we're under the ADEA's remedial regime, if there's no loss of income or benefits, let's say up through the time that that Mr. Barton returned from the FMLA leave in September of 2005, what remedy would be available, and how would we measure it?
Well, the retaliatory action of removing him from his position after he complained and assigning him to the sales training manager position, for which he was unskilled and untrained, is the retaliatory action that was adverse. It would dissuade a reasonable worker. And that is the action that was retaliatory. Under the retaliatory provisions of ADEA, Mr. Barton is entitled to recover the emotional harm that putting him in a position he was unprepared and not allowed to prepare for are recoverable. Are we talking about just the ADEA discrimination or the ADEA retaliation? Because retaliation under ADEA has a broad range of remedies that include compensatory damages.
I thought he was given about 6 months to learn the new assignment.
No, he was assigned to do a course outline and needs assessment from September until December. He was just doing the needs assessment as to whether or not we need this course, where the areas of difficulty are, and to put together a course outline. It wasn't until just before Christmas, the end of December, before he was told he was now the knee sales training manager who had to actually teach the class and fill in the technical content portion regarding Zimmer's complex knee products.
And then he had several months to do that before he had to do his prototype presentation that
not really
didn't
because
go very well.
They did not start working on the actual content of any of these executive level classes until the middle of January. That's what the evidence shows, that they started the content development on about January 13th. And then, even once the content was developed, it would have to go through Zimmer's legal department to get approved before the class could even be presented. And the presentation was at the 1st of March. So we're down to barely 6 weeks from the time of the content development to when the class had to be presented. And the problem there was that the personnel who needed to provide the training to Mr. Barton weren't available. They were gone. They were busy doing this AA, I can't remember the letters for it, but there was an event that was supposed to happen that didn't happen because of the hurricane, And it got postponed, so everybody was out of the marketing department who needed help.
Yeah, but how does all of that amount to retaliation for having filed the ADA complaint?
The retaliation happened before Richardson was gone. It happened when Zimmer removed Barton from his position and put him in a position where he was responsible for knowing the technicalities and complexities of Zimmer's knee products, hips, trauma, and extremities products. That's when the retaliation occurred.
Tori, about that. It's just a change in his job duties. It's not anything
but it
less responsible than he was doing. It just because he was required to learn a new field.
But they didn't provide him the training for the new field. It was an extremely different job. It wasn't trivial. It wasn't inconsequential. He was responsible for teaching consultative selling skills and leader and management training. Now he was responsible for teaching the technicalities and complexities.
And what prevented him from learning that position?
There was no on-the-job training. He had no one training him on these areas.
I thought he was told to use the online resources of the company.
There weren't online resources other than to go out there on the Internet and see what's available to the general public. Those were the only online resources. I mean, this isn't an area, and I think the evidence is very clear in the record, that this isn't an area that you can learn on your own. You require intensive training. Mr. Krupp's affidavit, Mr. Klein's affidavits, they both explain, as well as Mr. Barton's own testimony, about how complex and time sensitive the training is for this area. Mr. Radford required months and months before he was able to go into a classroom. He was hired in October. He didn't go into a classroom and do presentations on his own till the following April. And then he was in there with Mr. Bowman to help him. So, and he had Mr. Bowman taking him with him to all of the knee sales training classes in the meantime. Mr. Barton got none of that when he was put into that manager of sales training position. So that's why a reasonable person would be dissuaded from complaining if they were going to be taken from a position where they already possessed the skill and expertise and put into a position that they had none. They didn't have the training, and they weren't provided the training.
Mr. Rockwell,
he was set up to fail.
Could we go back for just a moment?
Sure.
Perhaps this is a gap in my knowledge, but you said a moment ago that emotional damages are available in the right kind of case under the ADEA.
Yes.
Could you direct me to some cases?
For retaliatory discharge under the ADEA?
Yes.
Your Honor, I don't have those at my fingertips. We cited them in our underlying brief on summary judgment, and I'll be happy to submit supplemental authority to the court.
Well, the issue has come up in the briefing here, and you are urging us to extend cases from other statutes.
Regarding discrimination damages under the ADEA, we believe that there is authority out there that retaliation damages under the ADEA are expansive and include the compensatory damages. And I'll be happy to supplement the record with those authorities.
Is there ever any attempt to seek any recovery or recompense under Indiana law?
Workers' no, Your
comp
Honor.
Or anything like that?
No, Your Honor.
Would there have been available to do that? Intentional infliction of emotional distress or something like that?
It is an extremely high standard, and we just chose not to pursue that avenue.
This was an easier route you determined.
It appeared to be, since we had direct evidence of age discrimination and direct evidence of the retaliatory removal of him from a position that he was able to do and assignment to a position that took months and months of training that was not provided. Should I proceed?
Sure.
Okay. When Milton came in, we believe there's more than sufficient evidence to show that she had not only a retaliatory animus, but an intent to retaliate based on her dear friend having lost his job instead of Mr. Barton losing his job. The very first words she ever spoke to Mr. Barton were that he is not to say one negative thing about Richardson, that Richardson was a true genius and did a world of good for Zimmer. She proceeded to tell Serafino that one of the first acts she wanted to take was to place Barton on a performance improvement plan without even having seen any performance out of him. The executive level knee sales training class itself is very suspicious. There's evidence that it was a sham, that there's credibility issues about Milton's testimony regarding this supposed mandate for this executive level class that she now claims she had no responsibility in coming up with the idea for it or designing it, but in her deposition years before her affidavit, she said that it was something that they talked about after she got the position and that she worked together with Mr. Kramer on developing it. But the most interesting thing is how it just got dropped. Where did the mandate go if there was really a mandate? There's no evidence that there was ever a mandate. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
That's fine. Mr. Jackson.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Steve Jackson. I have the honor today of representing Zimmer. I am ably assisted throughout these proceedings by my partner, Shannon Reed. Any good work on this appeal is a result of Shannon's efforts. Anything less than good is mine. I'd like to start first with damages, because that issue disposes of all of the underlying issues, and the district court got it right in saying that Barton is not entitled to any damages, and therefore all other issues are moot. There are a couple of factual predicates here. First, it's undisputed that Barton lost no wages or benefits. That's at the supplemental appendix, page 258 and 259. He was paid every penny that he was ever owed at Zimmer, so he has no damages. Secondly, Barton conceded that there's no constructive discharge or actual discharge in this case. That concession is found in footnote 3 of their appellate brief. And finally, Barton's damages are claims for emotional distress, and that is all. The district court so found in its second ruling on summary judgment at page 10. And with that, it's useful to review this court's history of dealing with the issue of emotional damages in the context of the ADEA. This court started its inquiry in 1982 in the Pfeiffer versus Essex case, where it thoroughly reviewed the statutory language and the legislative history and concluded the ADEA's remedial template drawn from the Fair Labor Standards Act excludes damages for pain and suffering. The court again revisited that issue in 1993 in its Moskowitz case, and the timing of Moskowitz is important because we know that in 1991, Congress amended Title VII to expressly include compensatory and punitive damages. And this court said there is an overpowering inference here that since Congress amended Title VII and didn't amend the ADEA, that Congress must not have intended for compensatory and punitive damages, including emotional distress damages, to be permissible under the ADEA. The Moskowitz court went on to say two more things. First, only Congress can change that remedy. So if you don't like this ruling, go to Congress, as Congress amended Title VII. But then most importantly for the issue raised by the amicus in this case, this court in Moskowitz said, we will not go outside the strict terms of the remedial template of the ADEA. We will not bite on the invitation to only get a little bit outside of it just because only a few people would be affected and there wouldn't be very many lawsuits. The court in
I think it's pretty well established that emotional distress damages, psychological injury damages are not recoverable as compensatory damages under the ADEA.
I'll move on.
To the extent that there's an alternative theory beneath the surface in this case, that this is a form of front pay claim, which would be cognizable under the ADEA because of its nature as an allowable equitable remedy, so that this would be analogous to front pay in the case, the Supreme Court's Pollard decision,
right,
which permits front pay awards where the plaintiff is inhibited from returning to work because of a hostile work environment or other sort of psychologically induced inability,
right,
to return to work. I mean, is there some way to theorize the damages in this case under that?
No, they're easily reconcilable because Pollard contains the condition preceding Pollard. There was a discharge, a constructive discharge. And then the court said, under undisputed legal principles, when there's a constructive discharge, you consider the issue of the emotional status of the plaintiff to determine whether reinstatement on one hand or front pay on the other is the appropriate remedy. But the condition precedent is the constructive discharge. And Barton admitted in footnote 3 of his brief before this court, there is no constructive discharge in this case. That's how those cases are reconcilable. There's no condition precedent in the form of a constructive discharge here. And, of course, in the Supreme Court in Schlier, I think, crystallized and finalized this by saying, we understand that the ADEA and age discrimination may cause emotional distress. We get that. But as Justice Stevens said, both at page 330 of that opinion and in footnote 6 at page 336, the fact that harm is caused does not mean there is a remedy under the statute. That's for Congress. Then let's turn our attention to the adverse employment action. There are three cases that are controlling here that demonstrate why Mr. Barton did not suffer an adverse employment action. The first is this court's 2002 case in Hernreiter. And Hernreiter set forth the standard here where there's a lateral transfer. So when there's a lateral transfer and arguably someone's skills get stale, the Hernreiter court said there are two conditions subsequent to liability. The first condition subsequent is that someone at the employer must perceive the employee's skills to be eroded or stale. The second condition subsequent is they must act on that perception and assign him a task. And here's why Zimmer wins on this issue. The phrase the court used is the new job must be not objectively inferior, with the emphasis on objectively inferior. Neither of those conditions subsequent are satisfied by Mr. Barton in this case. Mr. Barton cannot point to anyone at Zimmer who considered his skills to be eroded. It is uncontested.
What about Mr. Richardson?
Mr. Richardson is already gone.
No. Prior to the... Well, we know Richardson,
yes,
effectively stripped him of many duties.
That's right.
We have cases that talk about sort of proverbially putting somebody into a new job in a closet.
In the closet, the third prong of the Hernreiter standard, yes.
Okay. It would seem to me that at least for summary judgment purposes, you've got enough along those lines to show an adverse action there.
No, Your Honor, because that's what Hernreiter says. That is the first part of Hernreiter. Was there a lateral transfer? And it arguably moving Mr. Barton to...
A lateral transfer in which you keep your pay, but you're put in a closet effect.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever closet Mr. Barton may have argued that he was in, he emerged from that a short time later with no damage to his career when Ms. Milton, the first thing job she tried to give him on September 14th was the power selling job.
Well, what about the evidence that she also started him out on a performance improvement plan?
She never started him on a performance. She considered...
Explain the evidence from your perspective. I'd be interested to hear the...
She testified unequivocally in her deposition. She never put Barton on a performance improvement plan. She considered it, but the reason she considered it is because she gave him this task of revamping the sales training materials for knees, and he didn't accomplish it. He had 5 months to do it and never accomplished it. So her consideration of a performance improvement plan was after Barton had left, after February 7th of 2006, not before. And, you know, this court has repeately held in the Ajay, I'm going to murder the pronunciation of this case, but that considerations and plans that never come to fruition are the quintessential not adverse employment actions. So you can think about doing those things, but it's uncontested that she never did. So the, my argument on Hernreiter, though, is after the lateral transfer, there are two conditions subsequent, and neither of them ever happened in this case. Sherry Milton didn't consider Mr. Barton's skills to be eroded. And the important thing is the job that she gave him, the knee sales training manager. The test in this court, is it objectively inferior? And there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that anyone at Zimmer considered knees to be objectively inferior to
sales
training.
That was your most important product, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Our most important product.
The it seems to me, Mr. Jackson, that if a theory is going to work here for plaintiff on summary judgment, a linkage needs to be established between actions Richardson took or Richardson's motives. I think you have to concede that there is at least enough evidence as to Richardson's animus, both retaliatory
and for purposes of summary judgment. I concede that.
We've got that. So the plaintiff has crossed one big hurdle here.
That's right.
But then the question, since this is a rather unusual case in which the bad guy boss allegedly then winds up getting removed, is linking his attitudes to Milton.
That's right.
Where does Abel fit in? It seems to me that one can argue, look, Abel is the link here. He was helping and enabling Richardson prior to September, and he continued working with Milton on the Barton issues afterwards.
Yes. Abel fits in because Abel decisively breaks that chain. The plaintiff's theory is that Richardson was working with Abel as a part of this grand conspiracy. But the facts are undisputed that on August 22, 2005, when Barton sat down and spilled his guts to Abel about all these mean things that Richardson allegedly did, Abel went out over the next 5 days, interviewed all 11 people in this department, and recommended and fired Richardson. That is what is so bizarre about the plaintiff's theory, that there is this cabal of people at Zimmer who want to fire older workers. When you look at the record, it's Richardson who got fired, not Barton, not Klein, not Schieferstein, not anyone old. This record closed on February 27, 2008, when Bob Abel filed his last affidavit. That's 4 years after these statements allegedly made by Richardson. And in those 4 years, none of these folks had been fired. So that's how Abel plays in. It is a reasonable inference to say that Abel was swept along by Richardson until Abel got involved and went out and interviewed everyone in the department. And then Abel understood that Richardson was a horrible manager. And again, it's Richardson who's fired. And that breaks that chain. The other thing with regard to that chain and Milton is that Barton conceded this issue away at the district court. I respectfully refer the court to pages 288 and 289 of our supplemental opinion. In the district court filings, Barton conceded that Milton assigned him the job based on the needs of the department. That is the quintessential a fortiori reason that's not discriminatory and not retaliatory. If the department needed someone to teach knees and she thought Barton was the person to do it, then that breaks all of the linkages and chains between Richardson and Milton. And that is a concession that Barton made in his briefing to the district court. And he cannot now come to this court, having told the district court that she made the decisions based on the needs of the department, and say that she made them for some prescribed reason. Simple issues of judicial estoppel and waiver don't permit them to argue that before the district court and then turn around and argue something different here. But there are two more cases that really hone in on why this is not an adverse action, and that Mr. Barton is just his subjective desire for jobs, not the fact that knees are objectively inferior. In Nichols versus SIU Edwardsville, the plaintiffs wanted to work on the Edwardsville campus, not in the East St. Louis campus, because they said that was dull and it was just patrolling the halls. It wasn't real police work. And this court said that doesn't matter. The subjective perceptions of the plaintiffs do not create material issues of fact, because the question is, are the jobs objectively inferior? It's not objectively inferior to police the East St. Louis campus instead of the Edwardsville campus. And finally, just this last year, this court decided a case that's really on all fours with this. In Lucero versus Nettle Creek, Ms. Lucero was a 12th grade teacher. She had problems teaching in 12th grade. She alleged, just like Mr. Barton, the administration didn't help her out enough. She was moved to 7th grade, and she complained bitterly, even though that her pay was the same, her perks were the same, and she was in the same building, she complained bitterly that there was less prestige in 7th grade. And this court said that's not a genuine issue of fact for summary judgment. The question is, are the jobs objectively the same? And this court held they were objectively the same, and summary judgment was affirmed. I want to touch briefly, though, on the claim that Ms. Rockwell just made about Mr. Barton wasn't given the resources to succeed. Mr. Bowman testified, and it's at page 93 of our supplemental appendix. All you have to do is go to the library. Everything that Mr. Bowman, who had this job, needed to succeed in that job was in the Zimmer Library. And it's uncontested at page 82 of our supplemental appendix that as to issues like polyethylene, Mr. Barton never went to the library at all. Additionally, Mr. Barton was given more help than anyone else in this department. He was given a research assistant, Ms. Kindig. No one else in the department got a research assistant. He was given 30 minutes a day of Mr. Radford's time. Mr. Radford, of course, has a full-time job at Zimmer. No one else was given 30 minutes of assistance. And finally, perhaps most importantly, Mr. Barton did not have responsibilities for the technical part of this project in the March 6th presentation. I'd respectfully direct the court's attention to page 104 of the appendix. It's pages 76 and 77 of Mr. Dawson's deposition, where Mr. Dawson said that they were going to have Dave Hatfield, who was the cruciate retaining the project manager there, to answer technical questions at this first presentation, because Mr. Dawson realized that Mr. Barton was a rookie at this, and he was going to need some help getting up to speed in his first presentation, and so they were going to provide him help at that first presentation.
Mr. Jackson, keeping in mind that this is on an appeal from summary judgment,
yes,
what are we to make of the fact that the company dropped this executive knee project that the plaintiff had been assigned to on the mandate of upper management shortly after the plaintiff left?
What you are to make of that is to draw your resources from the dozens of cases that say you're not a super personnel department and you're not to sit in judgment of a bad business decision. It was bad. We had this grandiose idea, Zimmer did, that a combination of Zoles and the executive level knee training would produce a better quality teaching experience for our sales associates. And we were wrong. But as the district court pointed out at page 65 of its opinion, you can't go from there to say that Zimmer invested dollars and time of its executives all in an effort to get at Bruce Barton. This was a big production. We spent lots of time and lots of money on Zoles, lots of time and lots of money on the executive training class, and from the record you can infer that it was a bomb. But that only makes it a bad business decision. And even the district court correctly pointed out you cannot go so far as to assume that Zimmer would invest all of that time and all of that money to get rid of one person. That is not a reasonable inference from which you can draw on summary judgment. The court has additional questions. I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I appreciate your time and attention this morning. Thank you very much.
Ms. Rockwell? You have 5 minutes in the bottle.
First, I'd like to address the damages issue. The facts are not undisputed, as Mr. Jackson claims, as far as Mr. Barton not having any wages or benefits lost. Mr. Barton did not receive the equivalent of his wages and benefits after his job was terminated on February 22nd of 2006 by Zimmer. He was already gone
by then, though, right?
He was on a leave of absence. He received a letter from Mr. Abel that said, if you're not back from that leave of absence by February 22nd, your job will be given away, and you are free to apply like any other applicant, and you have to be the best qualified for a position to get one here. He had no job at Zimmer after February 22nd, 2006. That's a termination. That's the second conclusion that Mr. Jackson pulled that he says is undisputed, that we conceded there was no actual discharge. There was an actual discharge. We conceded there wasn't a constructive discharge because Mr. Barton never quit. He was forced to take a medically necessary leave. His doctors ordered him not to go back to work. While he was on that leave, Zimmer terminated him. And he lost the difference between his salary and his benefits and what he was able to receive through disability benefits. He did his best to mitigate those losses, and the calculation of damages that we submitted to the court as back pay and front pay were nothing more than the difference between what he was able to mitigate and what he was able to recover. There
this
is
case
no
really
claim
hasn't
in this
been
case.
Litigated on a termination theory.
Pardon
this
me?
Case really hasn't been litigated on a termination theory.
It was argued in the district court that he was terminated on February 22nd. Absolutely it was argued. It was argued. The court dismissed that, just disregarded it.
Well, it hasn't been argued on appeal in that way. The focus has been on the retaliation and the discriminatory change in his job duties.
Well, no, in the damages
termination theory.
In the damages section, we talk about he was terminated, actually terminated. It is argued in our brief, Your Honor. And this is not a claim for emotional distress damages. So the case is talking about the inability to recover emotional distress damages under ADEA are inapplicable. The ADEA's strict terms of that statute allow equitable remedies without limitation. And this court has interpreted those powerful words to mean an invitation to the district courts to be creative, to be imaginative, and to construct whatever remedy is necessary to meet the purposes of ADEA in making victims of discrimination whole.
What remedy are you requesting, and on what authority?
We are requesting, on the authority of the front pay and back pay case law that we cite, Mr. Barton's difference between the wages he would have earned, the benefits he would have received, from the time that he was forced to leave on that medically necessary leave until his retirement at age 65 when he would have retired. He was forced to do everything after that point to mitigate his damages because Zimmer caused his discriminatory removal from that position by making him unable to perform. We believe that
he didn't do anything to mitigate his damages, apparently. He didn't seek any new work.
He was unable medically to seek other work. What he was able to do, he did. He obtained every benefit he was able to obtain to cut off the amount that Zimmer would owe him. And the fact that he received Social Security disability does not cut off his right to reinstatement, as the court said. He is entitled to be returned. The court could have been creative and come up with remedies of reinstatement, a demand that Zimmer put him in a selling skills position, one that he had the training to do, at least for a nine-month trial work period. It has been years since all of this evidence about his injury. Time heals all wounds. We don't know what would happen if he was able to work.
If he was disabled certifiably, then how could he have been reinstated?
Because Social Security disability allows you a nine-month trial work period. That's how he could have been reinstated. Because his disability...
The doctor told him he couldn't work.
That was in 2007. We don't know now in 2010 whether he could try working if the environment changed. The doctor said he could not work in that kind of environment. And at that time, he was so totally disabled he couldn't work at all.
Ms. Rockwell, if we were to agree with you on the remedy that you're seeking and you ultimately proved your case, who would get the benefit of the Social Security benefits and the disability and the private disability benefits? Would it be Zimmer that would get the benefit?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
They get the benefit of that as mitigation. And that's what our expert calculated.
Why wouldn't we simply say he gets the full back pay and Social Security and the other insurer are entitled to a lien on that? It's taxpayers who stepped in. Why would Zimmer get the benefit of their generosity?
Perhaps they would. I don't know. But the other issue I did want to address is this was not a lateral transfer. If you look at the evidence, the affidavits of Curris and Krupp and Mr. Klein and Mr. Barton, all of them explain in detail this was not a lateral transfer from selling skills to the sales training position, and Mr. Bowman's testimony is hotly contested regarding that.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.